Life is incredibly seasonal. In the last few weeks, I've enjoyed the turn of weather. It marks a change of clothing and habits. Days are cooler and they're shorter. There's something wonderful about seasons that remind us of the Lord's provision and how dependent we are on Him as creatures. Yet as Christians, it's easy for us to approach seasons passively. Life can easily happen to us. But as we all know, discipline is key to living a deliberate, intentional life, even amidst various seasons. One of the historic ways that the churches approached life purposefully was to follow a church calendar. This marked specific seasons of the Christian life that helped people to be more deliberate in their spiritual reflection. This feels foreign to many of us today, but it may be a practice worth reviving. Today on the podcast, we explore how tradition and the church calendar can aid us in the Christian life. Hello and welcome to the Center for Christian Living podcast. My name is Chase Kuhn. I'm coming to you from Moore College in Sydney, Australia. Today, I have my good mate, Mark Ernge, on with me. Mark is the head of church history here at Moore College and my neighbor. Mark, good to see you, mate.
Great to see you, Chase. It's been so long. I love it.
Mark and I literally live across a field from one another and our offices are two doors apart. Yeah. It's great to be sitting here with you, Mark, and really glad to be talking to you today about church history.
Oh, my favorite.
I know it is, and I want to talk about how history impacts us in our Christian living. That is, as we think about ethics today and the practice of the Christian life, why in the world would things past matter for the present? That's really the essence of it. Yeah, we're going to zero in on tradition. We're just coming out of the Lenten season, the season leading up into Easter. Some will know what that season is, some won't. But it's part of an annual cycle of seasons that have marked out the church calendar for a very long time. First of all, what is a church calendar?
Oof, good question.
And how does it work? What's it for?
Great question, Chase. And great to be on the podcast. I love this podcast. I'm a devotee. I listen to it in my car. It's on my Google podcast list, and as I'm sure it is for many of your listeners. Church calendars, well, we know what the church is and we know what calendars are. We used to rhythms. We used to various kinds of calendars, Hallmark calendars and annual things we mark and celebrate, birthdays and anniversaries and all sorts of things. Some things in life we can forget at minimal consequence if you forget to brush your teeth or something. But other things, if you forget, there could be rather significant consequences. Could be your wedding anniversary. You'll have to forget that one.
Yeah.
You'll be up the creek if you forgot that one. And I think that's something that's significant just for human beings. We work on these annual systems of things. The church calendar taps into a bit of that, but really it also comes from a place of just looking at the way God's spoken to his people throughout the ages, really, to remember things, often remembering things annually. Throughout the Old Testament, there's lots of annual things and practices, days that are set apart, more than annually, times that are set apart, demarcated, you might even say consecrated as holy or set apart, which is what that term's getting at. So God calls his people to remember things. Jesus tells us to do things in remembrance of him. In 2 Peter in chapter 1, there's a great verse in verse 12 that says, "So I will always remind you of these things." He's just been talking about the eternal kingdom of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. "I remind you of these things even though you know them and are firmly established in them." So something about a biblical practice of being reminded about the things of God and salvation in Jesus, even though you might know them.
Yeah.
Because we're forgetful people. So remember, remember, remember.
Yeah.
So what am I saying in all this? The church calendar is something that in the wisdom of people who've come before us, they've thought, how do we help people remember the gospel of Jesus? You don't want to forget that. That's going to have consequences. It's not like forgetting to brush your teeth. And what are ways we can think about times to set apart and stitch into the fabric of things to help us remember? And the church calendar was a big piece of that.
Yeah.
It's not the only thing, regular teachings there and all that, but it was a big piece of just life, the warp and woof of life. Wouldn't it be great to stitch into the patterns of all of our lives, ways of remembering, whether you're old or young, you know, black or white, different languages, different educational abilities, work out ways of helping Christians remember the things that they already know.
Yeah, that's very, very helpful. It's fascinating the ways that our minds work differently too, isn't it? Visual reminders, tangible reminders are things that can actually stir up our memory, which is what Peter goes on to say there as well. I want to stir you up by way of reminder. And he's trying to work into them that memory of particular ways of being as gospel people in anticipation of the kingdom. And each of these occurrences are ways of us remembering that message. You think back to the Passover, for example, in the Old Testament. You mentioned this particular feast, this festival that was remembered every year. Here's an early gospel, if you will. Here is God's redemption of his people, marking them out as his people. And every year, take this meal a certain way, meet together as my people this way, tell the story again a certain way, so that you don't forget.
Totally. Practices.
Yeah.
I often think about the Feast of Booths.
Yeah.
Make this little arbor, like make a cubby house.
Yeah.
You know, like use your hands, make this thing. And there's something to do with practices.
Yeah.
That you can inhabit that actually, I think that's part of just being human really, is your tradition creatures, your creatures of habit. And habits are important. Sometimes we speak about them as disciplines.
Yeah.
But I feel like these things are important just by virtue of being human.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just to take it out of the spiritual realm for a moment and just to just everyday life. I mean, we love big breakfasts as a family. So on the weekends, we'll take a day, usually it's Saturday mornings, and our family has a big breakfast together.
Yep.
It doesn't do anything other than mark out family is important.
Yep.
And we remember as we sit at the table to love each other, to serve each other, to enjoy each other's company. And sometimes that's more challenging than others, right? It's hard to serve, hard to love, hard to enjoy, but it's really good.
Yep.
And it marks out a particular time and makes it a priority for us.
Yeah. Yeah.
So tell us about the ways that the spiritual family then marks out significant events in the Christian calendar. What are the highlights? I mean, we can go into a lot of detail about a lot of days.
Don't start me, Chase. Don't start me.
I know, mate. I've been there before. I wasted a few afternoons doing that, mate. Jokes. Let's talk about one. Advent, for example.
Yeah, right. Yeah, sure.
Advent's an important time of expectation.
Yep. Yep. So just like we've got seasons, summer, winter, August, what's it called? Autumn.
Yeah.
Spring, fall, here in another part of the world. I don't know what fall is. But there you go.
It's when the leaves fall, mate.
Yeah, thanks, mate. That's very good. Yes, yes, leaves falling. Yeah, anyway, okay. We're used to seasons. That's just part of the cycles built into the natural order of things. And so the church calendar in different parts of the world was geared to the natural seasons. They time things in similar ways, but it's not like that everywhere. But one of the principles that is in the church calendar is this idea of seasons, annual cycles, seasons. And so the church calendar has sort of set up over time, different places and variations, but the guts of it, the core of it, there are these things called seasons in the Christian year. And those seasons start with Advent, which kicks off, we might think of it in December, but technically it's just before that. It's a certain amount of time away from Christmas. So you might go through Advent, which is a Latin word, Adventus, from the first coming, thinking about the second coming of Christ. And then you move to Christmas, which is a season, thus the 12 days of Christmas, my true love sent to me. It's not a day, although it is a day. It's actually a season. And then you move forward to Epiphany, which thinks about the appearance of Jesus, the arrival of Jesus, and you think about his life and what he did and the miracles and the followers that came after him. And then you move towards a period called Lent, which some of us will be familiar with. That's sort of the season that we're traveling through at the moment. And that's a 40-day period leading up into Easter. And then you've got the Easter season, Eastertide. And then you remember other events after Easter, of course, when Jesus came back from the dead. You've got Good Friday and Easter Day. And then you've, of course, got the Ascension and then Pentecost. And you move through to Trinity Sunday. And then there's got this season called Ordinary Time, which is really nice because it's just reflecting on the ordinary nature of the Christian life. And then you kick it off again when you get back around to Advent. And that's the kind of basic guts of the Christian calendar. Mm. And you sort of observe a focus on Jesus, which is the way it should be. You know, focus on Jesus and his significance and retelling the gospel, the coming of Jesus, the life, the saving incarnation, the saving life, the saving death, the saving resurrection, the saving ascension, the saving giving of his Spirit. I can't think of a better way to just stitch. What a cool thing that the church has thought in its wisdom. Let's stitch into the life of our churches, remembering the things you already know, the saving work of Jesus in this way. Did different Christians approach all of that in different practices, in different kinds of churches and different places around the world? And African countries might be a bit different from Sydney and, you know, different places. But that's the guts of it. And however you cash that out, it's worth just remembering that the guts of it, it's like that passage in 2 Peter, you know, remembering the things you already knew and were established in.
Yeah.
In a way, we might use the word catechesis, a kind of teaching piece, a habit-forming teaching piece. That is cool.
I love that. I love that. And the times that I think I don't need it are probably when I need it most, actually, because I end up thinking, yeah, I got this. I figured this out. And I end up losing proper reflection on the significance of something.
Yeah.
So let's talk about this. There's multiple dimensions of each season. That is, there is the opportunity to think directly, that is theologically, on what Jesus has done for us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But there's also the response that's appropriate to what Jesus has done.
Yep.
So in Advent, for example, the anticipation is something that is actually a spiritual discipline.
Yep.
How do you anticipate the Christ properly?
Yep.
How do you long for him?
Yep.
How do you confess your need for him?
Yep.
The Lenten season is a season of preparation,
mm-hmm.
not to try to make ourselves acceptable to God,
mm-hmm.
but in view of what Jesus is coming to pay for our sin.
Yeah.
To rid ourselves of sin that remains.
Yeah, I mean, in lots of ways, it's a beautifully reformed season. You know, reformed theology actually prizes reflection on the seriousness of sin and the absolute beauty of salvation in Jesus. And I think, actually, that Lent, beginning with what's traditionally known as Ash Wednesday — now, the Reformed churches don't generally do the ashing, that's a 19th century innovation — but a reflection on, actually, Cranmer's Day in the Anglican tradition, it's a combination of sinners. It's got this really heavy reflection on the doctrine of sin and God's wrath and the punishment we all deserve at the start of Lent, so that the period of 40 days leading up to Easter, you can, you know, actually meditate on your sinful nature. And that's not fun, but it's good in the sense that you realize that you're a sinner who clings to Jesus. And so, personally, the more I've lent into this, get that, Lent?
That's right.
The more I've lent, I didn't even intend it anyway. The more I've lent into this, the more I've appreciated coming to Good Friday and seeing, you know, it was my sins that held him there. And coming to Easter Day and thinking, risen with healing in his wings. I've personally found that spiritually beneficial, because I think I've approached it with a reformed biblical perspective on theological perspective.
It's beautiful. Yeah. And it's not navel-gazing then. In other words, you're not down looking into your own soul, trying to find your own remedy. When you think about the 40 days of preparation, you're thinking about Jesus's temptation in the wilderness and his overcoming of temptation on our behalf.
Yeah.
And then reflecting on your own propensity towards giving into temptation.
Yeah.
And you can call out with Paul at the end of Romans 7, "Who will deliver me from this body of death?
A wretched man that I am."
That's thanks be to God for Jesus Christ our Lord.
Totally.
We are actually liberated by what Christ has offered for us now live in his new life.
Yeah.
Praise be to God.
Yeah. So yes, I kind of like to think of, you know, it's a good example thinking about Lent, but these kind of pieces in the Christian calendar, I like to think of as, it's like in the wisdom of the church has set up these markers and buried them like little time capsules. And as you go through the Christian year, it's like you're digging a little time capsule up of truth, gospel truth, and you're getting excited. You're remembering what you already knew.
It's rich.
You know, you're saying, thank you for planting these little time capsules throughout the Christian year that I can retrieve and go, oh, thank you. This is a good word, a good gospel word.
And that's rich. Rich.
take a break from our program, I'd like to bring to your attention a few bits of news from the Center for Christian Living. First, we're starting a new initiative in our podcast where we want to hear from and interact with listeners like you. Many of you have burning ethical questions or scenarios that you'd like advice about, and we'd love to hear from you. Please send us your issues and listen out for an answer in our upcoming episodes, where we'll begin to feature a short segment on your ethical challenges. You can send them to us through our contact page on our website. Second, I want to invite you to some very special events in June. As we continue through this year's series on A Virtuous Life, we're privileged to have an international guest speaker for our June events. Professor David Van Drunen of Westminster Seminary in California will speak at two events in one evening. On the evening of June 7th, we'll begin from 5 to 6 p.m. with a public lecture on the glory of true humility. Then after a dinner break, where in-person guests are welcome to roam King Street for some delicious eats, we'll come back for our CCL series event from 7:30 to 9 p.m. on the topic of virtue in an age of virtue signaling. I really hope that you'll prioritize joining us in person or on the live stream. And as a reminder, we host these events on Wednesday nights so that church Bible study groups can participate together. We'd love to have you or your whole group join us. The event continues to be by donation only, so come whether you can give or not. All the details can be found under the events tab on our website, ccl.more.edu.au. Now let's get back to our program.
Let me ask you some questions then, just for those that may be skeptical of the goodness of these things.
Totally.
What makes this season different from any other? Shouldn't we be reflecting on these things every day of the year?
Yeah. Well, there was a time when there were some Reformed and evangelical Christians in England in the late 16th, early 17th century that really believed strongly that no, these are all gospel truths that we should remember every day of the year, and therefore we should not mark out specific days for anything. Mm. So they were keen to abolish Christmas and keen to abolish Easter because of that consistency with that particular belief. There's a consistency there that's admirable and a principle that's right, that these things we can remember every day of the year. That's awesome. Well, we should, but we don't remember everything all the time, every day in the same way. I don't think I operate like that. Do you operate like that?
No, I'm finite.
I'm finite too. That's right. I need habits. I need rhythms. And I think that's just a creaturely thing, you know? And it's a wisdom piece, the church calendar. It's not a law of the Persians and Medes kind of thing, you know? Yeah. It's a wisdom piece. So it's like the church has said in its wisdom throughout the ages, here's a best practice piece of wisdom, yeah?
Yeah.
And it's not like there's an extra book of the Bible that says, thou must do this. But over time, people have thought, this is helpful. This is a helpful practice.
Yeah.
So I think that's a good way because, you know, I've come out in my own life through various churches and come out of a place where these things weren't a significant part of piety. I know people who've come from churches where it's always been a significant part of piety. So I'm really conscious of people, where you've come from shapes you. Yeah. And that sort of proves the point, actually.
It does.
Where you've come from shapes you and your tradition creatures. But it's always good to revisit your little habits and practices and think, could there be another really helpful habit and practice that I can take on for my sanctification that I might remember these things that I already know and have been established in?
With tradition, there's another objection I've heard often is that when we make something tradition, it loses its authenticity, that it's not an actual genuine expression then of my faith. It's more coerced from me because it's a repetition. Mm. It's something that I must do. Some people would say this in taking the Lord's Supper too frequently, but the same thing could be that I just do this because it's going through the motions. How do you help people think about that?
Oh, many things could be said. Great quote from Yaroslav Pelikan, the great historical theologian and collector of creeds, actually. But he once said that tradition is the living faith of the dead, whereas traditionalism is the dead faith of the living.
That's great.
And then he goes, and I suppose that it's traditionalism that gives tradition such a bad name.
Yes.
I think what he's getting at there is that you can do anything in a dry, rote, inauthentic fashion. You could sing lots of modern contemporary songs that someone else has written, not from the heart.
Hmm.
You could stand up and you could give a formal liturgy, not from the heart. And actually that, whether it's contemporary songs that you're just going through the motions with, or if it's a formal service that you're going through the motion with, that could be a form of traditionalism. But tradition is genuine faith inspired from the heart religion that's issuing in heartfelt prayers, heartfelt praise, heartfelt practices. And so I think that's a helpful way of thinking about tradition as a bit of a category, that actually what matters is doing things from the heart when you're putting stuff into practice. But tradition is a category as well. G.K. Chesterton once called it the democracy of the dead. And there's a sense in which we believe we're surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses. We believe that we're part of the communion of the saints. We believe that the church exists beyond us and it's existed before us and will keep going after us. We stand on the shoulders of giants. There are people who've come before us. We're not the first people to read the Bible. We're not the smartest people to read the Bible. And so tradition places you, it gives you a humility, I think, a dependence, not an independent, arrogant attitude, but a dependent, humble attitude that you see yourself as part of a greater whole and you could learn from that greater whole.
Yeah, I find that liberating.
Yeah.
I think I've seen this as well amongst even some young folks that are actually, I'm saying as if there's lots of youngsters running around. I mean, you and I are not so old ourselves. However, there's plenty of people younger than us these days.
There's a few.
But I think there is this desire to tap into something bigger than themselves.
Mm.
People feel lost in themselves. And I guess one of the great things of belonging to the great tradition is that actually I am joining something that has really predated me.
Yep.
And I get to be involved in it
yep.
by the grace of God.
Yeah.
Even mouth words that people have said long before me and yep. will say after me,
yep.
words of truth that will continue to ring out through history, testifying to the goodness of God.
Yeah.
So I love that. Just back to your point, the distinction between traditionalism and tradition is so helpful. And I guess maybe traditionalism could be equated with something like a Pharisaical religion. Mm-hmm. Is that mm-hmm. correct? It's the showing and going through the motions in a way that is really detached from that real
yep.
spiritual vigor.
Yep.
And I just wonder how you cultivate tradition
yeah.
over against traditionalism. How do you actually participate in the tradition
yep.
without traditionalism?
Yeah, that's good. The heart of the answer is really faith, true and lively faith, which of course recognizes that there's Christians who've come before you and there'll be Christians that will come after. So actually the traditions we inhabit aren't static things. They're actually dynamic things that will grow and that will continue into the future. I think sometimes our relationship to tradition can be a bit like a child growing up to a parent. So when you're growing up, you get to a point where you realize that your parents aren't omniscient and they don't get everything right, but actually there's a heck of a lot of wisdom there that you ought to benefit from it, live on with into the future.
Yeah.
So I think that it's a maturity thing, actually, to recognize tradition's role as not being infallible, but full of good wisdom.
That's good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So
we all go through a little bit of a season, though, don't we?
Yeah.
You see your parents and you think, yeah, they're not so cool anymore. I'll do my own thing
well,
for
that's,
a while.
Yeah, that's good.
But
yeah.
then suddenly you tap into realizing, wait, I should have listened to them. They were trying to tell me. Maybe they did know better after all.
They had a few runs on the board.
Yeah, I didn't want to believe it, but it was actually true. That's right.
Yeah, and then, you know, we often see that, don't we? Like when we teach at Moore College and we teach students, and as we teach and induct students into what people have reflected on the scriptures in the past, there's this kind of light bulb moments that yeah. people think, wow, you know, God has spoken and I can learn from people who've read the Bible before me.
Mm.
I think that's a maturity piece, you know,
it is.
And it's beautiful to see. And we all have to keep that attitude, I think, going forward.
I agree.
Yeah, now, traditions, it's not infallible. That's the other thing. Because the moment you start to say tradition's infallible, the moment you start to hit the traditionalism button, I think. But we must remember traditions, practices, theological traditions, confessional stuff, they're norms. But the norming norm is the Bible.
That's
helpful. It's the scriptures, yeah?
Yeah, and in each season, I guess, if you embrace a tradition, each season the best thing that it's doing, if it's functioning well, is driving you back into the scriptures to think about Jesus.
Totally.
That's what the seasons are designed to do.
Yep.
Like good liturgy is designed to do.
Yep.
So you're a man that loves his liturgy. Well, I love my liturgy as well.
Absolutely. Don't we all?
In large part, thanks to your influence. I love you for it, Mark. But we all have a liturgy, don't we? We can think we can get away from something formal That is something pre-scripted for us, something that was scripted ahead of time by somebody else.
Yep.
And I suspect that a lot of people's avoidance of that is that it's not immediately accessible in the way they would like it to be.
Yep.
In that it requires a little bit more engagement and reflection on the words that are so intentional that they can feel a bit difficult to maybe comprehend immediately or articulate from a position of faith.
Yep.
But if we dwell on them long enough,
yep,
if we think them through maybe even in advance,
yep,
or through repetition, that is through saying a liturgy,
yep,
regularly,
yep,
we actually begin to cultivate those words in ways that are deeply meaningful,
yes,
and almost in lifting our faith higher than it was before.
Yep.
What I mean by that is giving me better words than I could have otherwise articulated,
yeah,
to God. So I'm getting excited here, but I just want to know, Mark, for those that maybe have avoided the formality of a church calendar and maybe liturgies that would be associated with a calendar like that, how do you encourage them not to flee in the other direction as if something more holy is happening? It may be, perhaps, maybe not.
Yeah.
But it's all have a liturgy, right?
Yeah. So the word liturgy is a bit of an evangelical dinner party conversation killer. Let's be honest. Although,
if you go to evangelical dinner parties?
If you came around to my place, we'd have a great old yarn, yeah?
That's right.
As should most people. But the word liturgy can be used in various ways, but the way in which I use it now is just it's synonymous with, say, church service. But we've all got a liturgy. Every church has a liturgy that we use on Sundays. It's just a question of whether it's a good one or not. And so we've all got a liturgy. Whatever you do in your church, whatever order of service you have, that's your liturgy. Whether you like it or not, it is.
Yeah.
Whether you call it a liturgy is slightly beside the point. It's a liturgical thing. And so if you went to a Pentecostal church, you've got a liturgy there. You've got a bunch of songs. You might have a little short spot. I mean, I'm just thinking about a particular church in mind. I'm not speaking at all, but you might have a little short spot on giving. And you might have another song. You might have a Bible reading, a long sermon, an altar call, and some more songs. That might be a liturgy at a Pentecostal church. You might have a liturgy at a formal, traditional, classic Anglican church, and that might have four readings of scripture. You might have the Lord's Supper. You might have a sermon. You might have a couple of old hymns. You might have a confession, an absolution, a creed, the Lord's Prayer. I know which one I'd prefer. But every church has a liturgy. You might go to a pretty, you might call it an informal service. They might have some songs, might have a welcome, a few meteorological comments at the start, some songs. You might have a Bible reading or two if you're lucky. You might have a sermon. You might have some songs at the end. And that's your liturgy. So we've all got them. I think it's important to say and helpful to say that, and I suppose I alluded to this before, it's not the form of the thing which makes for authenticity. It's the heart of the thing, the heart of the person leading, the heart of the congregation members as they participate in that church service. That's the heart of the matter. It's the faith of the participants which makes a thing authentic or non-authentic. Mm. It's not whether words are pre-written or not. You can have an extemporary kind of service, and that can be just as inauthentic as a formal service if it's not done from the heart. All we've got to do is look to some of the big mega church stuff that's going on recently to look at the disconnect between true faith and piety and practice. Yeah.
Yeah.
The other piece I want to say is sometimes people say, well, pre-written words, they lack authenticity. And I want to say, again, no, it's a heart matter, not a form matter. And to make the point a little bit sharper, what do we do with all the songs in our churches?
Mm.
They're pre-written. You don't come to church on Sunday and say to everyone, okay, just sing whatever you like from the heart, please. You come and there's a set of words that someone else has written, probably from a few hundred years ago. And some of the language of those words might be a little bit foreign too, like, be thou my vision. Mm. We might be really familiar with that beautiful old hymn. But if you've come from a background, from another country, maybe you're exploring the faith, and you say, let's stand for be thou my vision, I think, well, what's a thou? And what's all this about? So we just got to remember that it's about approaching the form from the heart.
I love that.
Yeah.
And let's be honest, when we turn up to worship, we're going there with an intention. And we had a quote in chapel recently from our dear sister Jane Tuer, who said, the mature are easily edified.
Mm, that was good.
And the point is, if you come there mature in faith from the heart, you should be able to really be edified quite readily, quite easily. And I think the liturgy is meant to be a vehicle for that.
Yep.
With that, I just want to say we all have a liturgy.
Yep.
And even though we may not have a formal service, We will do something. And the question is how thoughtful it will be.
Totally.
Same thing about a calendar.
Yep.
We may not follow a church calendar.
Yep.
But we're all going to fill our time.
Yep.
The question is how.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
What are we going to think about?
Yep.
How are we going to be thinking deliberately about Jesus?
Yes.
And the question is, would a church calendar help us be more intentional?
Agreed.
Mark, I'm so grateful for the time today, mate. I'm really glad to see you again and glad to have you back on the podcast. Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, Chase. Always, always a joy.
To benefit from more resources from the Center for Christian Living, please visit ccl.more.edu.au, where you'll find a host of resources, including past podcast episodes, videos from our live events, and articles published through the center. We'd love for you to subscribe to our podcast and for you to leave us a review so more people can discover our resources. On our website, we also have an opportunity for you to make a tax-deductible donation to support the ongoing work of the center. We always benefit from receiving questions and feedback from our listeners, so if you'd like to get in touch, you can email us at ccl@more.edu.au. As always, I would like to thank More College for its support of the Center for Christian Living. And to thank my assistant, Karen Bielhartz, for her work in editing and transcribing the episodes. The music for our podcast was generously provided by James West.